And what some people probably don't know is that when you stand in front of the Beth Din on your mikveh day, the day you become Jewish, they say to you, are you aware that the world hates us?
This is Chapters, a podcast dedicated to exploring our story. Who am I and what am I meant to be doing in this world? Perhaps through listening, understanding, questioning, we better understand our own story.
Hi everyone, welcome. Today we have a very special guest, Nikki Kingslinger. Nikki is an incredible mom. She has worked in so many different areas of social media, including Cosmopolitan, Clio, and Dolly magazine. She currently works as social media manager in our local school. And ever since the 7th of October, you've really been an advocate. And I think for me, being an advocate maybe doesn't really seem like such a big deal. I live in a little echo chamber. Everyone I know really has the same opinion as me. And whilst I love to say my two cents and have my really strong opinions, it doesn't really affect my relationships. And I've seen the way you've collected people throughout your life from so many different circles, from so many different places. And those people don't necessarily have the same perspective as us. And I'm sure in the media circles, there's a lot of liberal perspectives and a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation. So the fact that you are an advocate for Israel, like I get anti-Semitic hate, like go die or Hitler should have killed you. And I'm not like some big social media person. So I think having a platform and being an advocate for Israel in 2024 is a really big deal. So firstly, what you have given to us, just like updating us with the news. Don't like I was following you and I was literally like, what is going on today because of your platform? And I think I want to hear about your experiences and how that has really come to be. Mm-hmm. But this podcast is called Chapters. So the way I think about it is that every person has a story and we're all part of like one collective story.
Yeah.
And your story is a really inspiring story. So I thought you would tell us a little bit about how you grew up and really start from like the way we say it is chapter one.
Yeah. So my name's Nikki and I grew up in rural New South Wales in Australia in a, I won't say small country town. It wasn't like a shanty town, but like a rural city in New South Wales called Dubbo. And it's a predominantly white and First Nations community. There is now, but when I was growing up, there wasn't a lot of other mixed races. You know, you had your one Italian family that owned this shop and your one Greek family that owned that shop. And there were zero Arabs when I grew up there and maybe one or two Asian families, one of which, you know, was a friend I went to school with and he was adopted. So it was like very Australian and very Indigenous sort of centric. So I think I can safely say, like, what growing up, I mean, it was also a different time, but it was also a very racist community, I think. I grew up in a bit of a racist household because we just didn't know any better. We only had a white person's experience in a small country town where there were probably a lot more injustices than we realized at the time. And I was born and raised there and I finished school there. I graduated there. And then as soon as I finished school, I left.
Literally. Peace out.
Like literally the day of my last HSC exam. My friend was waiting for me in the car park. It was my modern history exam. And she was waiting for me in her Toyota Corolla. And I jumped in the car and we drove to Sydney. And the only reason I went back was for my graduation and to gather the rest of my things. And then I came to Sydney and I never went back to Dubbo.
How far is Dubbo?
I still love
from
Dubbo.
Here?
It's like a 5.5 hour drive from here.
Oh, wow. It's really far. Yeah. And your family still lives in Dubbo?
Yeah. My sister lives there. My brother lives there. My dad lives there. My mum lived there up until a couple of years ago and she retired and moved closer to the coast, closer to Newcastle, where my other sister lives. And
wow.
I live here. So, yeah, our whole life is kind of around that area. And I still think I am very much a country girl on the inside, which maybe is what gives me like different perspectives to a lot of people around here. And I think I was always itching to leave, not because I hated it, because I don't hate it. I think like a small town upbringing is like the best you could ask for. And all of my best, closest friends are still the ones that I have from school and from my Dubbo life. You know, at the time I wanted to be a performer and I wanted to work in performing arts, and Sydney just was the next most natural place for me. And I found myself here because there was a lot of like performing arts situations and I had a job lined up and I knew Sydney. I was familiar with Sydney. So this is where I always wanted to live. I always wanted to live in Bondi. I always wanted to live in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. And so I guess I manifested that and came straight here and have been here ever since. And then eventually went to uni to study journalism. And then I eventually made a whole bunch of Jewish friends and became like this token not Jewish girl in you come to Bondi, it's not that hard. But, you know, I made, everyone always asks, like, how did you get so, like, in this community? I'm like, you meet one, you meet them all, right?
Literally.
Like, yeah, it's such a tight-knit community. It was, like, my first retail job. I met a guy there. We started working on the same day, who many people will know. He lives in New York now. And, yeah, he introduced me to his friends. He introduced me to my now husband.
Wow.
By accident. And, yeah, I just kind of slowly fell in love with the fact that I think it was the community that I fell in love with first and foremost, because I could see that these people were so like intertwined and so connected with each other and so like a part of something, and I wanted in on that. And so I started to get invited for Shabbos dinners and seders, and I just like the more I immersed myself in it, the more it felt good to me and right to me. And I think jumping back to my teen years or my preteen years, I did go through phases of like religious, what's the word I'm looking for? Like curiosity. I grew up in not particularly religious home, but a very spiritual home. And my mom was always very like, wanted us to explore like what our truth was and what God meant to us. And she would never tell us that something was not the right way, I guess. She was like open to everything. And so as a young kid, I had neighbors who were Christians, and I got really wound up in that community for a bit as well. I think I must have been like 12. And I was going to church and I was going to youth group and I was getting rebaptized and all of that. Like I was really into it. And I don't know if it was back then, you know, I was in a single parent household and I was much younger than my siblings. So maybe I was just searching for like some sort of unity, and I found that in religious spaces. But I think also I always had like this understanding of something bigger. Like it doesn't make sense that it's all just like matter and dust. And, you know, to me, like there was always something higher at play. And I had this understanding of this concept of not being the center of the universe from a very young age. I think I can still remember like moments of my life of like having these aha moments of being like, everything that I've just experienced today, that person next to me has experienced like similar. And then every single person in the world has experienced something completely different. And we're all just like going on this big life journey, and like, just like had like really big thoughts, I think, from a young age. This is kind of a bit strange, but when I started learning about the Holocaust as a kid, I think it was my big sister who put the Diary of Anne Frank in my hand when I was really young. She was always encouraging me to read, and I just became completely obsessed by that story and by those stories. And I went to a Catholic school, so we were required to study religion at HSC level, and you study the three monotheistic religions, so Judaism was one of them. And we visited the Holocaust Museum. I met Eddie Jackow, was the first survivor I ever met.
He was my tour guide. He changed my
life. Yeah, he was my tour guide. And I'm like this little girl from Dubbo, you know, and I come and he's like telling me about all these things. That's the first time I had heard someone actually say it. Now I've heard like millions of stories, you know, from survivors. But I was like, wait, if he's here talking to me about this right now and he's still alive, that means this didn't happen so long ago. Like this was my grandparents' generation holy cow. And I think that was another huge like aha moment of like, whoa, like this is like something bigger than I ever really understood. And I became really obsessed with like learning about the Holocaust and understanding it and feeling a really deep connection to it. I had like strange dreams about it. If I look back now, I can maybe say that it was Hashem like dropping me these little hints along the way over my life. I remember the night before I was getting rebaptized as like something that was my choice, which I actually didn't tell my family I was doing, so I was like ashamed of it in a little bit of a way. But we had mentors, and I remember sitting down in the church with my mentor, who was, you know, a teenager herself. And the whole concept of it was very beautiful, but I said to her, like, I don't understand why, if Jesus was Jewish, why wouldn't we all just want to be Jewish? Like, and she was like, well, just because, like, he changed everything. And I was like, but that doesn't make any sense. Like, you're telling me that the years started counting again because of this one guy. And then, like, I still went through with it, but, like, I always had that question. And I think I also asked that question again in year 12 or year 11 studies of religion to my teacher, Mr. Exner, shout out. But yeah, it was just like these burning questions that I always had. Then I found all these Jewish friends and I had these same questions. And instead of the answers being just because, they actually had potential answers for me, whether they were right or wrong at the time. Like, it could have been possible answers, you know, but serious answers about Jesus and about timelines. I never understood the timeline of anything until I started talking to Jewish friends about this type of stuff. And these weren't friends who were even like, it was my husband and his mates, like they weren't from at the time. We are now, but they had all been to like religious schools. They had grown up in religious circles. And so they had an understanding of it, whether they, you know, practiced it or not. There was, everyone had an understanding of it, the people that I surrounded myself with. And I was just like, whoa, finally someone's like giving me answers to questions that I've really probably had like majority of my life. And that kind of just sent me down a path of wanting to know more. And it felt like once I realized that Judaism was the first nation, like the tribe of Israel was the first, we were the first people to recognize that there is only one God. I was like, duh, why wouldn't you just go straight to that then? Like, there is no other answer for me. And so that's what set me down a path of wanting to dip my toes in and converting and going through that process. Obviously, that happened over a long period of time. But yeah, that's how I got here.
Wow. So it wasn't, didn't feel like a choice. It just felt like the obvious realization.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people assume, like, especially, and I hate this, that a woman who converts is converting because she wants to marry a Jewish guy, which sure, if like that is the reality for some people, but I think it's not the reality for all people. And it's especially not just a reality for women who convert. And I don't like that it's kind of portrayed that way. And I think a lot of people have kind of made that assumption about me as well. And I always say, like, if it wasn't my husband, it would have been someone else. Like, I would have done it anyway. I had a friend at university who I met at university who I obviously found out knew everyone that I knew. Oh, you know this guy? Yeah, me too. And so I would hang out with her. She was a bit younger than me because I was a mature age student. And I would go to her dad's house, who is someone that we all know, actually. And he was like, Israeli guy. He's like, no, just start now. Like, what are you waiting for? And she's like, Dad. And he's like, you don't need, you start the conversion, you get it done, and then you meet the guy. Like, it's obviously going to happen anyway. Why are you delaying it? So I always joke, like, if it wasn't Jeremy, my husband, it would have happened anyway. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I think it's true. Like, I have a lot of really good friends that converted, and a lot of the time they say, we always learned growing up that everyone's soul was at Sinai, like this like spiritual conception of it. But the more I speak to people that converted, like genuine people, that it's so obvious that like your soul was there too. And it was just like a random, like it could have been, you would have gotten there in any path because that's where you were meant to be.
Yeah.
And I think that spiritual dimension, I've seen it come to life, like just listening to your story.
I found for me personally also is because we decided as a couple that we were going to do it. You know, Jem comes from a from family and I'm a very like all or nothing type of personality. And we decided that if we were going to do it, we would be observant by the end of it. And I think people kind of like try to put that on a pedestal when they look at me, like, oh, you're such an inspiration because you became from. But I don't like that either, because I'm very much of the belief that you start doing something and then you can feel it. You don't have to feel it first. Like, it can go either way. You don't have to feel it first and then do. You can just do.
Wow.
When I started, and my teacher, Aviva, called me for the first time saying, okay, is Jeremy putting tefillin on every day? I said, no. By the way, we're also going to Dubbo for Christmas this weekend, so we can't start lessons. And she's like, okay. she's like, is Jeremy wrapping tefillin? And I was like, no. And she's like, okay, well, he needs to wrap tefillin every day if you want me to teach you. Otherwise, we can't learn together. And I was like, okay. And so I didn't know what that meant. And I didn't know what that meant for him personally either. And I told him what she said. And he was like, all right. And so he just started doing it because someone told him to. And it wasn't until after the fact, like after months of doing it or a year of doing it or like however long it took, that the meaning behind it and the feeling of like, oh no, if I don't do this, I will feel like I have really missed out on something today. It came after. So it doesn't always have to be. The reality is, like you said, anyone who converts was at Mount Sinai. That's the belief, right? So if Hashem is in control of everything and someone decides to become Jewish, whether for a man or just, I don't know, like for whatever other reason, but they don't want to be from at the end of it, it's like, it doesn't matter. Hashem decided this for you. Like, you think they had some control over it. They didn't. Like, the neshama was always looking for them. And whether they light Shabbos candles and keep everything or whether they don't keep anything, but they still like wear their Jewish pride openly, it's like, that's what Hashem intended for that person. So who are we to like say one is better than the other? Do you know what I mean?
I love that. And I love what you said, that like the doing is the more important thing.
Yeah.
Because we all struggle with like the actual doing. And yeah. Judaism is like an action-based religion.
Yeah.
And that's something that is sometimes just have to do it. And it's like, that's what's so hard, because inspiration comes and goes in that way.
And also like it can go like this your whole life. Like it can go up and down your whole life. So one week you might find Shabbos really easy and amazing and beautiful. And another week you might be like, I hate this. Like, I remember during COVID, it would give me so much anxiety when Shabbos came around every week, knowing that I was in my house stuck with, and I'm sure a lot of people felt the same way, mm-hmm. with all my kids, with a newborn and no way to like send them to something that would just give me like half an hour to catch my breath. And we were all very, you know, down in the dumps and like full of misery. And Shabbos was not an enjoyable time. Tishrei was not an enjoyable time during that time, you know?
Yeah. And that's the time where everyone hangs out.
Yeah.
Like, it's the time of community.
Alone. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think you just got to embrace like the ups and the downs of it as well. And it's fine if it doesn't feel easy. Doesn't mean you're a bad person or a bad Jew or failing or going backwards. It just is. That's life.
And what was everyone's reaction? Like, was it something, because obviously you were you working at the time in media?
Yeah, I was. I think when we started dating, I was at Cosmo. And then by the time I finished and we got married, I was working at Clio and Dolly. I think because it was such a slow burn, first of all, me having all these friends and like going and doing all these Jewish things with my friends and then meeting Jeremy and then that whole complicated love story, and I think it was like as natural a progression for the people around me as it was, like at least the people who were seeing me every day, like my workmates, as it was for me. And so I was always very conscious of, once I started the process, introducing things very, very slowly, but always being really honest with the people that I worked with, being like, this is what it's going to look like eventually for me. Like, if you want to hire me for a new job, eventually I'm not going to be able to work late on Fridays. I'm not going to be able to work on Saturdays. If you still want me, I'm here, but if that's a problem for you, then we need to reassess. Hashem sent me like a huge gift when I was deciding whether to leave Cosmo and go to Clio, in that he had put Shari Markson in the editor's seat at Clio
wow.
magazine. And I walked in and I was like, look, this is the situation. And she was like, oh, I'm Jewish too. And I had never met her before. I didn't know who she was. Obviously now we all know who she is. She's amazing. But yeah, like the fact that she, and I remember going home that afternoon being like, my new boss, my potential new boss is Jewish, which means it's not going to be like complicated if I ask for Yom Kippur off or if, you know, I have to go home early on Fridays. She's like totally going to understand. Her granny goes to the shul that we go to. Like I was like, oh my God, thank you, Hashem. It's just like everything just kind of fell into place and happened really naturally. I mean, I don't know what people are saying behind my back, but.
And your family?
They seemed fine with it. My family was fine. I think there was maybe a bit of apprehension in terms of like they didn't know what boundaries that would create between us. And like, I guess they just like wanted to make sure I wasn't joining a cult. They could still hug me and they could still talk to me the same way that I wasn't gonna, you know. And I just had to tell them like time will prove everything. I know it's really hard right now. I know it's really hard when I tell you that I can't do this or I can't eat your food anymore or if it's Shabbos, it's going to be complicated. But my mom's been amazing. She's always like facilitating our kosher food and wow. making sure we have like disposables at her house if we come to stay. And it's like we've just shown them like you don't need to worry about it. This is our, I don't want to say burden, but this is our like project to figure out in terms of like how we're going to get all our kosher food to Dubbo to see everyone. And we take our little Weber and we take our meat and we take our cheese and we can pretty much buy everything else in Dubbo. So yeah. It's not that big a deal. And we can still have meals together. It'll just be a little bit separate. Like we won't be having bacon and eggs with you in the morning, but, and so I think once that kind of, and that took time, I think once that time passed, they realized that everything is pretty much the same and that I am pretty much the same. But I think also like people forget, like as you get older and you start to have a family or like whatever changes it is you go through, you get a new job, whatever, it does like mold you. So whether it's joining a new religion or whether it's getting a new job or whether it's jumping on some other advocacy train or having a baby or getting married, it's like it changes your priorities and it changes who you are as a person and it changes the way you see the world. So I think people forget that, like that people like to put the whole thing on, like, I know this was a big change for me and for my family and for my friends, but a change is going to happen regardless. So
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone experiences change.
Yeah. I think the hardest thing for me was like that I could see it working and I could see how easy it was going to be or like, but it still made me really anxious knowing that, that I was potentially frustrating them or letting people down if I couldn't be somewhere despite doing everything I possibly could. I went to all my friends' weddings. They were all Shabbos weddings. Like that, and that was like the time of life that I was at as well. It's like, we were all getting married. We're all having hen's nights. We're all having our first kids. And it was like really difficult to say sometimes like, oh, we can't be at that thing, but we can be at that thing. Or like, you know, finding an Airbnb close to the wedding venue so that we could be there on Shabbos wow. and like walking in our joggers so that we could be there on Shabbos. Because like friends would get married out of town or, you know, there were complicated ones where we could go to the service, but we couldn't get to the reception till after because they were such a far distance away and we couldn't drive. And like there were some hard discussions that were had. But I think when you have people who love you, they're not going to like, it's hard in the moment, but they're not going to like hold on to it forever.
But like I'm saying, for me, I could just say like Judaism is just like obvious. Everyone that's around, I'm not sacrificing.
Yeah.
In that same way.
Yeah.
You really, you have to really be so strong in your values and you can't like people pleasing, let's say like that probably goes out the window because yeah. you really have to stand up and say like, no, I can't do this.
Yeah.
And sometimes people just won't. Understand
they
it.
Understand. But you know what I think that's taught me also? It's taught me more like how to be more empathetic to other people as well. Because if someone can't be there for me in that moment, I'm not going to get riled up about it because I've been that person as well that couldn't be there for people. And I just want everyone to like not be stressed out because I know how bad it feels to be like, I think I'm a very naturally guilty person anyway. Like I feel like guilt that the emotion of guilt like weighs heavy on me all the time. Like I always feel like I'm letting someone down. Like I walk into a room and be like, sorry, I'm here. but I hate that and I don't ever want anyone else to feel like that. And so I think going through that process has helped me be not so hung up on what other people are doing. Like, do what suits you, do what suits your family. If you can be here, great. If you can't, don't sweat it. Like, we would be more than happy to host you in our home, but if you can't make it, that's fine. If you're changing, it's like, it doesn't matter to me. I don't want anyone to be stressed. Like, we should all just like live and let live. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's been like a huge positive that's come out of it as well.
Wow. What was like one moment? Do you like remember a specific moment that you found something really difficult and you were like, you had to like go back to like, why am I doing this? I don't know if you can remember.
Yeah. I would say one of the most difficult things was, it's probably two, and they're very similar, and they both are around weddings. And one was like, I was on the cusp, like I wasn't even Jewish yet, but I was putting the pressure on myself. I was on the cusp of like wanting to take on all the laws of Shabbos, but I wasn't even Jewish yet, so I didn't even realize that I didn't have to at that point. But you do need to prove in some way to the powers that be that you are doing everything that you can to like make this transformation. And one was my cousin's wedding, and I was like, I just don't think I can be a bridesmaid, because she asked me to be a bridesmaid. I was like, I just don't think I can do it. It's really complicated. Like, I'll be this far into my conversion by then, and it's on a Saturday. Jeremy won't be able to be there because he already keeps Shabbos. And I had to have that conversation with my sister of like, she begged. She's like, can you not just do this one last thing? Please, it's like, this will be the last thing, and then we'll stop asking you to do these things and we'll work around. But please, like, it's, she's only asked family. And that was like just an internal struggle for me. But I'm so glad that I did do it and that I was the bridesmaid, because I was putting probably more pressure on myself than I needed to at that point in my life as well. And so that was one. And the other one was a friend's wedding, who was the one who was getting married in one location and then having a reception very far away. And I could tell that she was feeling really betrayed at the fact that we couldn't get on the bus to go out to the reception. And it, like, I was crying at my desk at work. Like, I didn't know how to handle it. But I had to just be like, if I start making concessions at every single turn, like there's always going to be concessions, then what am I telling you as my friends? I'm telling you that this actually doesn't mean everything to me. It only means something to me. Or maybe I'm sending you the message that I'm only doing it for show or whatever, or that I'm doing it for someone else when I'm not. I'm doing it for me. And by that time I was Jewish and we were married, and it was very much like, you know, I was a shaitel. Was I wearing? I think I was a shaitel wearing yid by then. Maybe I wasn't wearing, covering my hair. I wasn't covering my hair yet. I didn't cover my hair straight away. But I was married. I was Jewish. It was like a big thing for me. And believe me, I tried to find every possible way to be like, can I get on the bus? Like, is it possible? Is there a halachic way for us to do that? And I guess I realized I was doing that just to kind of satisfy someone else. And it's really hard to explain to someone, especially on like the most important day of your life, that my movements that day aren't going to affect your day. That's a really hard lesson to learn, especially when you're in your 20s and like your wedding day is like the most important day. If it was my wedding, I would have thought that it for sure would have messed up my whole day as well. Like, so I could totally see where she was coming from, and it killed me that it was hurting her so much and it was hurting me so much. And I think it caused like a little blip, but she's like one of my bestest friends, and I tell all my secrets to her. Like, it was probably a real reflection of like this big change that I was going through, playing out in real time. But we got to the wedding and we got to the reception. And yes, it felt hard at the time, but I'm glad I stuck to my guns, because it's like you're kind of saying like, no, I've chosen this. And this is why I'm saying, going back to that lesson that I've learned about empathy for other people, this is a choice that I have made for my life, and no one else's life should really affect that. Why should it? It's my life. Let me do what I want to do. I'm doing everything I possibly can to meet you at the table, you know, and extending myself. I'm walking in like 40 degree double heat in a beautiful wedding outfit to see you get married, and then walking back again. I will be there the minute Shabbos is over. I'm in the car, I'm on the way. But like, it's just hard. It's hard for people to accept sometimes.
It's like a no for a greater yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a blip. I knew it was a blip. That's what I always had to tell myself through the whole process, was that, like, time will prove everything. Like, time will make everyone see that this was all worth it, I guess, that I haven't changed. I haven't, like, sacrificed something on one end for it to, like, all blow up in my face and it not work out at the end of the day. I think that's, like, holds me to account as well. It's like, no, everyone around me has had to make sacrifices. So I need to prove it to them also that, no, this is, like, all the sacrifices that we all made were worth it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what was, like, sneers like?
Oh, my
modesty.
God, it's still hard.
I mean, I struggle and I grew up with it. So.
Yeah. I think in the beginning I was just kind of like, it was hard because I was working in fashion. And in the beginning I was like, well, if I'm a good stylist, if I'm good at my job, then this should be really simple for me. But I think, like, any sort of, like, coming into a new identity, you kind of just do what ticks all the boxes at first. But, like, you eventually one day turn around and be like, this is not reflecting me. Like, I do not feel like myself. So it was like figuring out how to be sneers and also feel like my old self. It was figuring out what really was I comfortable with. Was I still okay wearing jeans under dresses? Yes. Like, that does not weigh on my heart so much. I really wanted to cover my hair, but I didn't do it straight away because I knew that, like, it's such a crazy concept and that I didn't want to, like, jump into that too soon. So we went on our honeymoon to Israel 6 months after we got married. And I was like, I'll just buy one when I'm in, like, cause I'm there. I may as well buy a shaitel while I'm there. Cause you can't get back then. You couldn't get, you know, as many options in Sydney. And we were away for like a month. So I was like, we got home. I was like, should I just rock up to work with new hair? It's like this, like, you know, 6 inches longer and like way healthier and a bit darker than what I like left with. And no one knew that it was a wig. Everyone's like, oh my God, Nikki, your hair grew so much on holidays. So I did start wearing it because it just felt like a natural progression. And also in Israel, I felt like I could try it on and take it off without the judgment of community being like, well, are you wearing one? Aren't you? You know? I was like, just let me test the waters while I'm over here and no one knows who I am. So I did that and then I came back and I put a shaitel on and I haven't taken it off since. And kind of still feel myself. I miss pants. I don't think at this age I would be particularly not modest anyway. Like, I don't feel the need to, like, show certain parts of myself. But I do wish we could wear pants. I'm a tomboy at heart, and I would probably be. And before I was sneers and before I was Jewish, I was a jeans and a t-shirt and a baggy jumper girl, like, through and through. I had, like, a pixie haircut. I was, like, proper tomboy. So I think, like, that part has been hard. But I've also discovered, like, a more feminine side of myself, which was nice. But, yeah, if I could just wear, I mean, baggy pants are in fashion now. Like, surely.
Can move to a kibbutz in Israel.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it's funny. I remember, like, the first time I went to Israel, everyone was like, oh, my God, just you wait. Obviously, as someone who was, like, just coming up as, like, a newly frum, newlywed, everyone's like, just you wait. You're going to go to Israel and you're going to see how easy it is to be from there. And I went to Israel and I saw how easy it was to be from there. But I also saw how there was, like, zero accountability there. And I was like, if I went to Israel, I would not be keeping sneers for sure. I would for sure keep Shabbos. But I would not be keeping – that would be the first thing to go, I think. And maybe that's a sign of, like, maybe putting too much focus on the politics of sneers rather than the, like, spiritual – meaning behind it, which is something that I need to work on. But I think when you have, like, a community that is small and that holds you to account, it makes you feel more a part of something. So I guess it's not about, like, no one holding you account in Israel. It's about, like, struggling to feel a part of something as strong. Like, here we have to really try harder, right? Because our community is so much smaller and we live in Bondi Beach. It's like a very, like, cool place to be and everyone's, like, wearing the latest trends and, like, all the D-list celebrities are walking around and the influencers, and it's very easy to get, like, caught up in that and want to be a part of that. And so here you've got, like, you have to have a little bit more, like, fight in you to walk out every day and, like, represent yourself as an observant Jewish woman. I kind of like that. Like I said before, I'm an all or nothing type of personality. And I think that kind of motivates me a lot. Whereas if I lived in a place where there was so many like ranges of varying like levels of observance, which by the way, I love, I think I would start to feel myself making excuses for myself.
So I want to like fast forward a little bit. So you're doing the Jewish thing, you're involved, I think I like remember you at this point now, like married to Jem, and you're still maintaining all these relationships, which I think that must have been like a lot of sacrifice and a lot of effort. And again, I live in this little echo chamber. And then the 7th of October comes. And before we get there, I first want to talk about like anti-Semitism. Was anti-Semitism, obviously you were aware of it because you went to the Holocaust Museum, but was it something that you ever actively experienced?
No, not violently, not like aggressively. Definitely like heaps of microaggressions. Even when I was working in media from media professionals, it would be like throwaway comments like, oh, don't they all just like care about themselves and money? Like I had someone say that to me, a very high profile person. I remember trying to explain to an editor, an actual editor one day, if the Jews didn't have Israel, then for sure another Holocaust would happen. She's like, do you really think so? Like, I don't think so. And I'm like, any nation that doesn't have a state or a military to defend them is the most vulnerable nation in the world. So yes, like that, surely that's just like logic. And we already saw what happened when we didn't have that. So just things like that. I've had people sit on my couch and tell me that Jews run the banks and Jews run the world and that we have control over the governments. And I'm like, cool. I've had heaps of microaggressions like that where I've felt uncomfortable. And in the beginning, maybe I didn't understand anti-Semitism as well as I did now because it wasn't so prevalent 10 years ago.
Oh, I didn't even realize anti-Semitism existed before like 4 months ago. I thought we were past that.
Even like the war 2 years ago, that kind of like brought it all back up again. But I was always put in like uncomfortable situations like that, but I never knew how to like shut that down because I wasn't geared with the responses and the armor that I have now because I've obviously learned a lot about it. And what some people probably don't know is that when you stand in front of the Beth Din on your mikveh day, the day you become Jewish, they say to you, are you aware that the world hates us?
Whoa.
It's really confronting. And you've got three rabbis sitting there, like, saying very casually, are you aware that the world hates us and you will now be subject to anti-Semitism? And you say, yes. And then they ask you a few other questions. And at the time, I was like, yeah, but, like, who hates Jews? Everyone loves Jews. Like, it was 10 years ago. It was Bondi. It was, like, to me, that was the cool club. Do you know what I mean? And you see so much in pop culture and creative spaces, especially in media and fashion and like, you know, and I just think no one hates Jews. Are you kidding? That's ridiculous. But it wasn't until I started, I think I followed like an Instagram page and they don't exist anymore, but they were Mizrahi Jews running this account. And they were basically, their whole thing was talking about Mizrahim and how they kind of get lost in the discussion. Like everyone talks about Ashkenazi culture or Sephardi culture, but no one really talks about like the Arab Jews that existed in that land from the beginning of time and how when they went to Europe, there were signs everywhere saying, go back to the Philistines. Now that we're in Israel, they're like, go back to Europe. It's like, where do you want? And that for me was like, whoa, we've literally been pushed out of every single place, especially these guys, especially the Mizrahi Jews, you know, with Arab backgrounds, the Iraqis, the Tunisians, the Libyans, like they were all pushed out of these Arab and African countries and told to go somewhere else. And then they were kicked out of those countries as well. So they went back to where they were told to go. And now that's being weaponized against us as well. So I think that was like a big, like following that account was like something that kind of made me dive into the whole like understanding anti-Semitism better and how it attacks on all fronts from the left and the right, the white, the brown, you know, we get it from everywhere. And it's like that's when I started to feel a little bit dire about the situation. Like, oh my God, this is way more than just Jews dying in the Holocaust. You know, this is way more than Hitler. This is way more than neo-Nazis or KKK members. This is like so much more complicated. And once I started going down that road of like listening to people who really knew a lot about this, then it started to become deeply like heavy for me and personal. And I always say, I know that I am a white, Australian-born, blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl who likely has no ties to the Middle East genetically, aside from the fact that, and this won't fly for a lot of people, aside from the fact that my neshama was at Har Sinai, and aside from the fact that my kids now have Iraqi blood, you know, so my offspring are now like descendants of Iraqi Jews. So I always wonder if people like watch me say this stuff, especially when I'm advocating on Instagram, if they watch me say this and be like, Nikki, you're a white girl from Dubbo. Like, what do you know about feeling a connection to the Middle East? And I totally get that. And that is really valid. But I think because I understand the Jewish nation as an ethnicity and a religion, and I live a Jewish life and an open Jewish life, and I'm very visibly a Jewish woman with a headscarf and a Magen David and three sons who wear kippahs and tzitzis, and so wherever we go, we and a husband who wears a kippah in public, you know, we are very visibly a Jewish family. So at the end of the day, whether I'm white or not, I'm still going to be vulnerable to people attacking me in public spaces. You know, like when anti-Semitism is high, it's the visibly Jewish people who cop it the worst because we wear our identity on the outside and we can hide it if we want, sure. But why should I have to?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I feel like maybe that's like a personal insecurity.
Yeah.
That you think that like, oh, because you grew up in Dubbo, then like what is your ties to the Middle East? Because I think that through this whole experience, the one thing that I've recognized is even though like I do like check the Free Palestine pages and they love to talk about like genetic testing and like where we come from and all of that. But I think just even the terminology that's used in the anti-Semitic attacks are always like Yehud, like kill the Jew.
Yeah.
And they're not saying kill people with Israeli passports. That's not the focus. And I think because of that, it doesn't even matter. And they love to like go back and be like, Bibi Netanyahu, where was Shimon Peres from? Genetic testing, 99% Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
To recognize that this conflict actually has everything to do with like being Jewish, more specifically than anything else, because there are so many countries in the world that have had, that have done far more immoral things than Israel. And Israel is put so, even though everyone loves to deny it, Israel put so much effort in being moral, and the disproportionate response, the only way to rationalize it is because we're Jewish.
Yeah.
Because there are so many problems in the world going on right this moment.
Yeah.
But Israel gets the disproport, like it's literally the front page of every newspaper. Yeah. It's literally going on the BBC all day. And I think it's a Jewish conflict, it's a Jewish story. And I think because of that, it's very much every single Jewish person's problem.
Yeah. You're probably right. It probably is like a personal hang up that I have, because I know in the beginning, I used to try and get involved of my, you know, being Jewish. I used to try and get involved in these conversations because I felt so passionately about it. But I was often met with, from my Jewish friends, maybe you don't quite understand because you don't come from Holocaust survivors. Or maybe, you know, you weren't around at yeshivas when they spoke about X, Y, Z or this, this, that. And so maybe it is like a personal thing because things do get said to you like that. Even like, you know, you get your microaggressions from your non-Jewish friends. You also get microaggressions from your Jewish friends, especially in the beginning, especially if you're deciding to become observant. So you kind of harbor, I think, some things that aren't warranted.
No, I think you chose this Jewish life.
I remember saying to a friend when I worked at Cleo and Dolly, and this was all around the time when I got married, which is when ISIS was really like in the headlines, and the Lindt Cafe siege happened, which was a terror attack in Sydney. The day after my wedding, we woke up to the news of the hostage situation in the cafe. I remember feeling so, like, on the inside, scared for people who presented as a religious minority. And I remember trying to say this to a friend. It's like, I need to write an article about this or something. I need to get this out. Like, I don't know what to say. But, like, all of a sudden, I'm like, my fight is so ingrained in, like, this minority group that I don't even feel white anymore. And she was like, whoa, you're not white anymore. And I'm like, I know that I'm white. Like, I know I'm as white as it gets. But I don't feel like that represents me anymore, like my actual, like, being, my insides, my soul anymore. And she was like, that is a really big kind of aha moment. So I don't know how to explain the connection to people who don't fully understand it. I know that when I saw the Kotel for the first time, I couldn't even walk down the stairs because I just burst into tears. I was so overwhelmed. My husband just, like, potted down. He'd been, like, millions of times in his lifetime, and I just stood at the top of the stairs, like, with, like, blurry vision because I, like, just burst into tears. Maybe it was just, like, the release of the 3 years before of me, like, working so hard to get to this moment, or maybe it was, like, something deeper than that. But, like, I think anyone will tell you, like, anyone who's been to Israel, anyone who has family in Israel, who has friends in Israel, who has visited once, twice, a million times, who reads about Israel every single day when they study Torah, like, we all just, it's very hard to explain the connection that we have to that little tiny piece of land, to people who have never been or never experienced something bigger than themselves.
It's undeniable that there's spirituality in this world.
Yeah.
Like, love, emotions, you can't feel them or touch them. Mm. I think being Jewish, it's so much more than ethnicity, in the sense that there are black Jews, there are white Jews, there are Jews, Asian Jews, there are Jews from all over the world.
Yeah.
And there are Jews that didn't grow up Jewish. And the fact that it's a soul, like, I really, really believe that the only thing that makes this whole thing, it's so irrational. Like, some of the hatred is so irrational. Yeah. And it just emphasizes that we are irrational people, and the love that we have for each other. Like, you didn't see, I'm not trying to put down the people in Ukraine, but, like, this inextricable connection. We are all over the world, all connected, all passionate about it. This love and this passionate connection we have, it's not obvious. It doesn't make sense. And the fact that you grew up, let's say, in Dubbo as, like, a white Australian, but yet this is 100% your problem.
Yeah.
It just shows that you get that soul that comes inside of you, and all of a sudden it doesn't even matter. Like, this is your story.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
And that's hard to explain that for people that are not, that didn't grow up like it,
because it's part of something like that.
It's not rational. It's not easy to explain.
Yeah. I guess now, like, having kids, it's also, like, it's personal now as well, because it's the safety of my children. Like, I don't know what world I'm leaving them with. And if I don't fight this fight now and expose what I know to as many people in my sphere, from my Dubbo days to my media days to my Jewish days, it's like, if I don't help people understand this, then I haven't done enough for my kids. And I'm really scared of, like, what I'm bringing my family into, like, what type of world they're going to be raised into. And all I can really show them is that, like, being the light is all that matters, and bringing more Jewish babies into the world to be a light. And I don't mean that in, like, a pretentious way of, like, oh, we're so much better than you, like, we need to show you the way. I just mean, like, raising good humans who do good things. Like, it's so intrinsic in our service of Hashem to, like, give back and to do for others and to be part of a community and to make meals for new moms and to gather together when someone dies and, like, not leave people out, like, by themselves. And I think that's all I can really hope to teach my kids. But I'm so scared of, like, that our voice is not the loudest. And that, I mean, throughout history, it's always been the bad guys who have been the loudest. So whether they're in small numbers or big numbers, you know, I think once you add kids into the mix, if you didn't grow up in this way, like all of a sudden I've got Jewish kids that go to a Jewish school with armed guards out the front and who look Jewish in the streets. And I have to make sure that I do everything I can to the people who know me and know my children to know that no matter what happens, they will be protected by everyone that has ever like come into contact with us in the different eras of my life.
When's the first time you realized there was like a conflict, like a Palestinian-Israeli conflict? Was that something that in your Dabo days, did you think about it or was it?
I thought Israel was like, first of all, I didn't even realize Israel was like a real place. I went to a Catholic school. I graduated at a Catholic school. I didn't learn so much about Jerusalem. I learned about Bethlehem. I learned about the story of Jesus. And I thought these were all like potentially real places. I didn't realize you could actually go there. And so maybe that's just because I wasn't paying enough attention in class. But I didn't realize it wasn't until I started learning that like I could go to Masada, I could go to Jerusalem, I could touch the walls of the temple, I could like walk the streets where so many biblical characters have walked, no matter who you believe in, like they were all there. And I think that was a big like whoa moment. And so I definitely didn't know that there was such a conflict between Israel and Palestinians. I didn't know anything at all about post-World War II and how a place was finally given to the Jewish people after World War II. I didn't know any of that. I didn't know about 1948. I didn't know about Geneva. I didn't know about Balfour. I didn't know about 67. I didn't know about Yom Kippur War. I didn't know about any of it. I didn't know about First Intifada. I didn't know about any of it. Like, I didn't know that there was this little slice of the world that was being targeted, not just by like its neighbors, but by the world at large for so long. And I think I probably didn't realize, I'm trying to think of like maybe the first kind of real time acknowledgement of like anything crazy happening is when they released Gilad Shalit. And I remember being, I must have been at like hanging out with friends one night. It was nighttime in Australia, I think, remember, when they released him and all my friends were on their phones, like watching it or listening to it, like, oh my God, they're handing him over now to, and I was like, who, what? Like, I couldn't even remember his name. Like, I'd never heard that name in my life. And for them to tell me, like my friends to tell me how, you know, this is someone who had been held hostage because he was an IDF soldier. And I was like, whoa, that really happens? And then I think also as ISIS and everything kind of gained traction, this is like 10 years ago, and being in the headlines a lot, that kind of like shifted my focus to Middle East sort of relations and terrorism as a whole. And then obviously having more of a connection to Israel, I guess, how that all kind of tied in was probably, but it really was not that long ago. And I didn't grow up with this as part of like my school curriculum history lessons.
So when did you start like realizing the importance of like educating yourself?
Heaps. It probably like shot into the stratosphere 2 years ago or whenever it was, 3 years ago now, 2.5 years ago with the tunnels and that attack, because I started to see how vile everyone was on social media. And that's when I spend a lot of my time. And I was like shocked at how people could be so unforgiving and so like forgiving of people who literally built tunnels in. Like, I was like, imagine if that happened anywhere else. Imagine if Victoria was tunneling into New South Wales and people were coming out and just like stabbing you in the fields. What the hell? But like, so that last war was huge for me in terms of understanding just how backwards the rest of the world had it, including people who I used to work with and go to school with. But before then, like even the 2014 war, I don't remember it so vividly. That was like the year I finished my conversion. That was the year I got married. And so maybe I was kind of like in that little bubble of just like focusing on my own self. I remember being in Israel and like the first few attacks happened when we were there, like random stabbings. So when the stabbing like thing went crazy in 2015.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah. And I was like, whoa, this is sketch. And when the three boys were like taken and murdered. So it's like as each really big tragic thing has happened, it kind of like over the last 10, even 5 years, it's kind of just like gotten stronger and stronger. But I think definitely it affected me most starting 2 or 3 years ago. Like it was heavy, like I was crying every day and I was really confused and I was trying my best to articulate to all the people around me of like the reality of the situation. But I don't think people were as invested in even in that as they are in this one. And it's almost like the worse it gets for the Jews, like the worse the attack is on us, the less people on the outside, like anti-Israel advocates, tolerate from us. Like it's like, I always used to say, like, I almost want something really bad to happen so people will see the truth. And even yesterday I was reading a text message from a friend of, we were talking like on October 12th or something. And I'd obviously been like in bed for a week straight or whatever it was. Me and Jeremy, we were both like just glued to our phones for days and days and days on end. And I remember them saying to me, like, how they were like supporting me so much. Like, I can't imagine what you're going through. I hope your family is okay. Da, da, da. Like everyone was really sympathetic in those first few days of like, holy smokes, this is crazy. What just happened? And I even said in this text message to a friend, I always knew that when something really, really bad would happen to us, that the world would wake up. And it feels like finally the world is waking up. Like, how dumb was I back then? Like, I was so hopeful.
3 months ago.
because that was the initial reaction and it didn't take long. And there were people on Instagram, really great advocates like Eve Barlow and everyone saying, just you wait. It's not going to stay like this. As soon as we defend ourselves, they're going to use this against us and they're going to come hard for us. And so it's like, it's just a sad, almost helpless sort of feeling. And I think the never endingness of it is also just like a really heavy weight to carry around every day, despite, you know, 4 months on, we're just trying to get back to, I mean, our life in the diaspora is very different to the lives of those in Israel. And I hope anyone who's listening in Israel knows that we are thinking of them every single day. And you might not see it, but we're advocating for you every single day. And we're doing memorials and we've had Shabbos tables and balloons and we're lighting Yahrzeit candles every week. Like we are thinking of you. And I don't know if people in Israel know that as like that it's as prevalent here as it is. People are begging to go on solidarity trips. It's hard to kind of like, we're so removed from it here because we're not in the war zone and maybe we weren't as directly affected because we didn't lose, thank God, at least anyone that I know, we didn't lose as many people in our like, you know, immediate nucleus, like everyone in Israel did, like everyone knows someone who lost someone there. But it's hard to kind of like carry on with your day while you're carrying that really deep sadness and deep like despair and like we're so far away from a solution. You know, it's like really heavy. And here, the war that we're fighting is totally different. It's like the war on anti-Semitism. Over there, it's like we're fighting terrorists, whereas here we're just fighting white feminist haters in the comments section and idiots at the Opera House.
So I want to hear like what that was like, because obviously you're very vocal on social media. What was it like? Were you ever feeling hesitant, ever posting anything? Did you ever have difficult responses?
No. I think also I post very strategically. And in the beginning, I was full of rage. I feel like we've all been through like the 5 stages of like grieving, but I was full of rage. And I go back and I look at the things that I posted the night that I turned my phone on after Simchas Torah ended. And it was like, I can't say the word, but it was like, forget that, forget Palestinians, forget Gaza, forget everything. I was so like wound up in my own like fear and pain. And like, finally, everyone's going to see how evil these people are and how, like what they did to us. Like it's really like not me. It's not my personality. But like, that's where I was at. And I was like rage posting, and I was posting everything because I just needed to get it out there. I needed everyone to see that they should be feeling scared and sorry for us and no one else. And that babies have been taken away and ripped out of their homes and are being held hostage. And then slowly, slowly, I started to see how not only heavy that is for people to like ingest every day, especially if you're not connected to it, like this little like pariahs coming onto Instagram being like, rah, 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 like swallow this. And I started to see, like, after a few weeks, my engagement kind of like dissipate a little bit when it comes to that stuff, because, and I totally get it. If you're not affiliated, it doesn't affect you and it's just too heavy. But like, then my attitude kind of shifted to like, oh, well, must be nice. Like, it doesn't affect you, but it affects me, because now there's swastikas being drawn on like Australian restaurants, and there are police parked out my kid's school, and, you know, there are people rallying in the streets every single weekend, putting like signs up that say like, put Jews in the bin. And, you know, it's like, so I was kind of like, okay, I understand that it's hard for you to process, but at the same time, like, if you love me or if you're connected to me in any way, then you should feel some type of way about this. Like, I would be horrified if my friends were going through this. But at the same time, I know that, like, it wanes eventually. Even as a Jew, it's, like, waned considerably, given that we literally could not get out of our beds for the first week or so. And now we're getting on with life. We're going back to school. We're getting on with our swimming lessons and, you know, lunch boxes and it, like, going and doing fun things during the week and going on Shabbatons and all of that, you know, like, so it has waned. We were paralyzed in the beginning and now we're not so paralyzed. And then it kind of changed to, okay, I feel like I need to listen to Israeli voices more. And I started to tune into what my friends living in Israel were talking about, because I felt like that was probably the most important message. And I think it's very easy for us out here to keep being really ragey and rage post and being passive aggressive and snarky and na 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 in the comments, but it doesn't get us anywhere being like that. And so I tried to really understand it from like a political standpoint. If I was in Israel, which side of the coin would I be on? What would I want? What would I want for I'm a boy mom and I know they're young, but if I, like, your kids are still your kids, whether they're 12 or 20. If I was a mom in Israel, what would I want? Would I want my boys to be going to war? Like, all of these other things started coming up for me. And then it just became a matter of like, let's focus on the situation with the hostages. Like, they should be, like, getting them back should be the main message, with sprinkles of the other stuff. And I did notice that all of my Jewish friends were all posting the same thing, and I could see the importance of what they were posting, and it kind of like connected all of us together. But there were some things where I was like, this isn't going to resonate with my viewership. And I'm not some like huge, massive influencer, but I do go in and I look at who's watching my videos often. And it's the same people coming back, of like people who I either used to work with or friends or people who are now influencers, like big Australian influencers who I used to maybe work with in media. And so I do it knowing that it's reaching some of them, and it doesn't matter if it's just a handful. And I remember I posted something not so long ago about like, I don't even know like why I bother, because Instagram used to be such a fun place for me and now it's become so heavy and so like anything you post, whether it's good or bad, people are going to judge you. Like if you post your normal life, your Jewish friends are going to feel betrayed by you. If you talk about the Grammys, which honestly is all I'm like, I really am interested in today, for being honest, not all I'm interested in, but like, I can't wait for the Grammys. You know, like we still have like these real human emotions. And even though it's still October 7 for us, like every single day is October 7 and it has been for the last 4 months, life still does go on. And whether that's now or whether that's when you're chas v'shalom, someone very close to you passes away, whether you lose a child, whether you lose a spouse. We all know someone who has been through huge, momentous, tragic things in their lives. and you've watched them like get back up on their feet, and you probably, we all have probably looked at them and gone like, how did you do that? How did you like bury yourself in the depths of grief and sadness, but then like dust yourself off and smile again? So I get really like upset when people are critical of like how people are trying to portray the situation on their social media, because if you don't like it, you don't have to come. It's their social media page. But I've always been really conscious of like, I don't need to share that. That's not going to benefit anyone in my outer circle who's not Jewish or not affiliated. But I also try to like connect dots for people. So this thing happened. Okay, hold that there. And then that led to this thing happening. And now can you see the connection of how that is problematic? Okay, so now can you see also that this thing, also just as a sidebar, this thing is also happening. And also let's not forget that Kfir Bibas is still a baby hostage and we don't know where he is. We don't know if he's alive. And like that should be our main focus. So I'm trying to not just like spam everyone all the time because it's too much and people can't, they can't like ingest it. It's like if you get too much of anything, it's not a good thing. Do you know what I mean? And we do it so that we are strong in our convictions. But I think people who come to me, and I've had people like come into my DMs and say, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't know any of this. Like non-Jewish, even like people who I'm not that friendly with, people who I went to school with or who have followed me for some reason because some other account posted me and they've been following me for a few years and they used to love the Jewish content and now they're like, wow, I've like learned so much through this. I had someone message me who I went to school with who was like, I live in Ireland and they're all very anti-Israel. And I got in a fight with someone over dinner. And it was all because of the information that you've been sharing. Wow. So even if you feel like giving up, and I can understand why it would be really taxing and why you just want to go back to posting about the Grammys or about the Oscars or your kids, like just know that it is reaching us. And it is like whatever you're teaching me, I'm like pushing it forward. So like I don't care if that's like five people. To me, that's still worth it. Because you don't know, like, what that can, like, the spider web that that can create.
Did you ever have any disappointments with people in your life?
Oh, my God, major. Major. Even in the last war, I had to unfollow people. And I don't even think they realized. These are beautiful people. I don't think they realized that what they were posting was really hurtful. Some people I've just unfollowed, like brands or whatever, because who are they to me anyway? But then people who I went to school with or I might see, you know, every couple of years at like a mutual friends gathering, you'll see them post about, they'll post about the court case or they'll post about like, I don't know, it's anything they can get their hands on. And they're not posting like I am. It's like once in a blue moon, they'll come out of nowhere and be like such and such. It's like sharing the story of how South Africa is calling Israel whatever they're saying. And it's like, wow, okay, I'm not going to unfollow you because I actually don't even think you know what you're talking about and we don't even have that much to do with each other anyway. There's one woman who I met through media. She didn't work in media, but I met through my job in media. We were both in a photo shoot together and we have very similar stories in that we grew up Australian and we converted to different religions. And She's a little bit older than me with older kids, but she has always been someone who I'm just like, we are a reflection of like how people can coexist. And we would always be in each other's DMs, supporting each other and helping each other, whether it was like about renovating or motherhood or whatever. She's, you know, in the past sent me some of the most beautiful life advice I've ever had. But she also works for an organization or is an ambassador for an organization that does not serve us, an organization that we now know is actually conspired against us. And first of all, her not reaching out to me in the days after October 7, before Israel even made an attack. And we're not close friends, but if you only have X amount of Jewish people in your life and there is a huge attack on Jews and you know that that person has family in Israel and it very much could have been like your sister, would you not just be like, is everything okay? I'm just checking in to make sure your family. So I didn't hear anything from her and that was stinging a little bit, but I also understand that she has a profile to maintain and that if I screenshotted everything that it could be, damning to her. It could be used against her. I get it. And then she would come on every now and then and post about who to support and about Gaza and only funding for Gaza and only funding for the organization that she worked for. And then it would be crickets. And then I could see that she wasn't watching any of my content, and that was really annoying me. I'm like, come on, you're a smart woman, really smart. Come on, come and see my stuff. I'm following all of your accounts. Come and have a look at what I'm saying as well. And then out of nowhere, she came and shared this article that she wrote about Islamophobia. And I was like, oh. I was just like, really? Really? Have there really, and there was some really tragic attacks, I think, in Europe or in America that weren't even done by Jewish people. It were done by other racist people that were very sad and distressing and ended very badly, of the child who was killed. But why does it always have to be that when we're talking about anti-Semitism, do we always have to mention all the other phobias and racist ideologies in the world? Why can't it ever just be right now it's just about us, because there's been however big percentage spike in hate crimes against Jews? And she wrote this whole report about how Australian Muslims are being targeted and seen as not human, and how the way the media writes about Palestinians makes them seem not human. And maybe we're just watching different news sources, but I'm like, all the news sources I'm watching is painting us out to be the not human ones. And maybe that's something that I need to look into and work on. But that for me was you've drawn a line in the sand. You clearly only care about your story, which she's not even affiliated, aside from being part of a certain faith. Doesn't have any family in Israel, no family in Palestine, no family in Gaza. Her husband is Egyptian. It was just as problematic, but no one puts any blame on Egypt for not accepting Palestinians. They have just as tall a wall as Israel does when it comes to keeping out Palestinians, keeping out refugees. So I'm like, okay, fine. And I get it. We all live in our little echo chambers and we all live in our little bubbles. And if I was her, I would probably be doing the same thing. But it just felt like I thought she was smarter than that. And I thought we had more of a connection that kind of rose above all that. But the fact that I didn't get any acknowledgement from her was really sad. And I don't know why. You know, some people just their inaction or their action hurts you more than anyone else and you don't know why. It's not even a particularly special relationship to you, but for some reason that person really gets you. That's what that person was for me.
What do you respond to people that ask you, what about the Palestinian children? Do you not have empathy?
Of course, I say, of course I have empathy. To me, every child in the world is innocent. Every one of them, because they're at the mercy of the adults who lead them, right? And we don't get born into the world hating people, and we don't get born into the world that believing that we should die a martyr or that we should join an army or that that comes from our leaders and the people in power, positions of power. If you're taking a baby to a march and saying, please God, one day she'll be a martyr, that's not their baby's fault. And that's not showing that child that there is more to the story or that there's a better life out there and that we should not engage in this stuff and that we should just do what we have to do to get by. That baby could have been the next. I'm trying to think of all the amazing Palestinian voices that we have for us, advocate or tell the truth about Israel and how amazing of a place it is.
Yosef Haddad.
Yeah.
I love him.
Yeah. And so every child to me is innocent. And when I've had really hard conversations with people who I really love, who have said, you know what, Nix, it's so nice. It shows that you're such a loving person that you can hold space in your heart for the children of Gaza and the Jewish children, or the children of, not even just Jewish children, Israeli children. It's not just Jews in Israel. So And, you know, they've said to me, but like, I just can't, like, I only have enough space for the children of my people. And that to me is like hard for me to hear, because I don't think that gets us anywhere, that attitude, but I totally understand where it's coming from. And I'm never going to be the person to tell someone, no, you shouldn't feel that way, because how do you tell someone to navigate trauma, like generations and generations of trauma? You can't. But I do think that, like, if we could just take every child out of, if I could take every child out of those, out of that situation, out of like Hamas leadership, out of the leadership of their parents who have led them astray, I totally would. Like, I would be like, I can show you that there's a better way to live life, and that we are not your enemy. You know, we don't need to raise people thinking that we are enemies. And I don't think, like, if we all think that we're like gifts from Hashem, we're all part of, we're all like human in Hashem's eyes, Hashem created every single one of us, then we all need to believe that there is a godly spark in every single person on this planet. And some, it's snuffed out completely and there's no going back. And they've like given into things that we'll just never understand. But I think if you're going to make the kid argument for me, don't even, because like my heart breaks every time I see a child in Gaza sitting in a hospital who is like shaking or traumatized or whose eyes are like completely filled with fear. Like, that really kills me inside, and I feel that very deeply, especially, I'm sure, like as a lot of parents do. But that doesn't take away from the fact that I feel so deeply about all the Israeli kids as well who are currently displaced and who were killed and targeted just for being there, just for living on that side of the fence. That to me is, I was trying to explain to someone, it's like in war, really sad things happen and people die, including innocent kids. It's the way it has always been. But there is such a difference between someone breaking into your house and binding you to your parent and setting your house on fire and looking you in the eyes and shooting you point blank and whatever other horrible things they did to our kids. There's a difference between that being your ending and being collateral damage in, sadly, an airstrike. Like, the difference between the IDF and Hamas and what they did on October 7th. It's like not comparable. So I think any child dying unnecessarily is like the worst pain the world, the collective world, could ever feel. But I mean, the way in which some of them died is probably way, had way more evil intent behind it than others. And that's something that I struggle to, like, when that argument comes up of like, don't I have empathy for the kids? Like, obviously I do. But I'm so, so sad to think of what the kids in the kibbutzim went through that day. I'm being so confused. Like, especially the little ones are being so confused of like, why is this happening? What is happening? I don't even understand. They wouldn't even know what a terrorist was, some of them, like at that age, like some of the victims. That kindy, that gun that got like completely, they all died. I don't think people talk about that. Like, there's like, I feel like there's still so many stories that have not been like the headlines. We hear the same stories of like the same hostages and the same victims over and over again, but there are some that are like so unbelievably sad. And you see pictures of a gun that's completely shot up and there's blood everywhere. It's like, why are you going into a preschool and shooting three-year-olds on purpose? At the same time, I also know that there is a lot of false, made-up information out there being fed to the pro-Palestinian side. And if you believe that, I don't blame the people for believing it, because it's really easy. It's really easy. It's really easy to believe it, to fall into the trap of believing like the evil IDF is doing like the exact same thing
to Palestinian prisoners. Like, it's so easy, if that's all you're hearing, to fall down the trap of believing that stuff and not thinking critically and not asking any questions, or even just not thinking anything and being like, wow, I've never been to Israel or the West Bank or Gaza. Maybe I just shouldn't have an opinion on this, and maybe I should just be sad and hope that it ends one day. Yeah, I think that's what bothers me the most, is that people aren't willing on both sides. People are so willing to believe everything from their side, and they're so not willing to hear anything from the other side. And I just don't think you can form a solid argument unless you're doing both.
Has your perception of like feminism and like all these movements, has it really changed?
Not with me, but as far as movements go, yes. But I've always felt that way about movements, and that's something that I've learned through learning more about anti-Semitism, because Jews have been excluded from these spaces for a lot longer. Like, before October 7, we were removed from women's marches, we were removed from the BLM movement, we were removed from, I don't know, every other, like, LGBTQ circles. We were, like, Jewish people weren't allowed to wear the Magen David at pride parades. So, I mean, I definitely, when the whole, like, Black Lives Matter thing was happening, I had so much empathy for that struggle. And I don't think I understood the BLM as a movement until some people started calling the movement out. And then I started to question a lot of other organizations and movements. But I think the fight is still a worthy cause. Like, I'm still a feminist, and I'll still fight for Indigenous rights, and I'll still fight for to end racism, and I'll still, you know, I'll fight for queer rights. I'll fight for everyone's rights, because I just want everyone to be happy. But I don't, like, fall so deeply into the trap of, like, aligning myself with particular movements anymore.
What do you think about, like, the whole Aboriginal, like, Nakba, Invasion Day, conflating their struggle? Is that something you experienced? You said you grew up in Dubbo with, like, an Aboriginal community.
Yeah.
Is that something that you've experienced?
At first, we started to see a lot of loud First Nation voices and accounts on social media being really anti-Semitic, and that killed me, because I had just fought so hard in my Jewish circles to convince people to vote yes, because in Australia we were currently going through a referendum that was to give Indigenous voices a platform where they could make decisions that were best for them, not even changing policy, just like have an advisory board the same way we have a Jewish advisory board. And so I really pushed for that and advocated and have always advocated. And so then when you see the Aboriginal flag flying at Palestinian rallies, where they're also flying flags of, like, putting Magen Davids in the bin, it was like, oh, that's brutal. And I felt really betrayed. And because I DM'd a few accounts as well, being like, you can't, like, this is not right what you're saying. It doesn't make sense. It's anti-Semitic what you're saying. And then having them block me and delete me, I was like, oh, God, this is like, it just feels like an impossible battle. But I have a lot of Indigenous friends, and I would never conflate the actions of some to the feelings of many. And I can understand why, if I were in their shoes and I had been fighting the battle for First Nations people to have, like, more say over how we govern this amazing country of ours, because I truly do think they know better than a lot of us sometimes in certain situations, I would never desert my feelings about that. And I think if they're, like, stuck in circles where they're being told, like, our fight is your fight, and where you can only understand it as, like, a brown people versus white people, like, I get it. I get why it's very easy for you to feel like, okay, your struggle is my struggle. But also, you've got to remember that a lot of Indigenous people who live in rural communities or in, you know, areas where there are no Jews, how would they ever know that actually our struggle is your struggle? and the struggle of Jews and Israel is the same as the struggle of First Nation Australians and Australia. And the connection that you have as a tribe to the earth and to the trees and to nature is exactly the same as the connection that we have to the land of Israel. Everything that we do is based on the land of Israel. We just had the new year of the trees, for goodness sake. Like, we're so like connected to the physical land as well. And a lot of our laws are around harvesting and harvest periods and seasons. So I just don't think many of them know that. You know, I learned recently, one of the biggest lessons I've learned recently through all this is that in the West, we're so privileged to only understand conflict or oppression through a Western lens of color versus white, or black versus white, or brown versus white. And that may seem like a shock to some people who are fighting that battle, but the fact that you've never had to understand conflict or oppression through the lens of the Middle East and the games that they play, the things that they're doing to Iranian women, the type of weird, sadistic, ideological power they want to have over not just the East, but also the West, and the games that they will play in taking hostages and then making Western countries pay them money to get those hostages back, and then using that money to funnel into terror proxies. It's just like, I've never understood any of this until recently. And so it's so easy for people out here to only be able to understand it through a poor, oppressed brown people versus white colonizer. But it's just like, you know, we should, I've always said in Australia, like, we are so blessed that we just do not have the problems that a lot of our Middle Eastern neighbors have. Like, Australians wouldn't even know how to comprehend the complicated and almost unbelievable games that some of these dictatorships play over there, and how Israel is very much a part of that and gets sucked into that despite really not wanting to be a part of that. We're one of the only democracies in the Middle East. So yeah, it's really made me realize that, well, lucky you that you can only understand it as black versus white, because that is a very simple way of understanding oppression and colonization. But, you know, I mean, what's the percentage of Arab Israelis and Jews? I mean, Arab Jews, like Mizrahi Jews.
I think it's like 60%.
It's more than white European Jews. So, but they just don't know that. Like, the Indigenous Australians don't know that. They don't live in areas where they would ever be exposed to that type of learning. So I think the best we can do is just try and, like, not give up on their fight, but just try and teach them. We're in, like, any spaces that we can. It's like, your fight is our fight. And I know that it's always the best of intentions. I'm trying to remind myself that. But you can't fathom the level of evil in the world unless you've lived it, unless you've been a victim of it.
I was in Israel and there was these posts like, oh, all Jews are white. And I'm like in this Mador Nora, this youth club, and like half the kids in the room were black.
Yeah.
And I was like, I think I shared a video there.
Yeah.
And the lack of understanding of what Israeli demographics look like.
Yeah.
So history obviously plays a really important role. And how has your passion for history, how is that really involved during the war, and how important do you think education is in this? It's not just a war, it's a spiritual war, it's a social media war.
Yeah. Oh my God, it's so important, but there's so much to learn. And that's what freaks me out as well, is that you can have Holocaust education, like, obviously that's really important in schools, but unless you're genuinely interested in history and modern history, even ancient history. I always say, if people took Israel's ancient history as seriously as they took like the pyramids, or even biblical history as seriously as, I think because people kind of like disregard religion for like, whatever, that's fine. Like, I understand why they disregard religion straight off the bat, that any type of biblical
history is just like off the table for them. But if they only learned it as real as they learned about the pyramids, like you have to do that at HSC level. If you want to study ancient history, you need to know about the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Assyrians, and like it's all part of the curriculum. So it's like, where do you draw the line? It's like, unless you have a genuine interest in it, I think it's very hard to digest. And I know that because a lot of my family and friends have said to me, I just wish I could retain all this information. And look, I didn't excel in my HSC and I studied modern history and I did not do well. It was my worst subject. I think now I would nail it. I think I would be so good at it. But that's because I'm older and I have a genuine interest in it. And I also have like skin in it as well, because my family is living in the Middle East. So, and they are very vulnerable at the moment. So it is really important, but it does feel like which parts do I feel like are the most important to tell people when there's so much that plays into it and it's all relevant.
What do you think is the most important?
Like World War One, World War Two, the history of anti-Semitism, how it manifested as the Jews killed Jesus, and then it manifested as the Jews run the banks, and then it manifested as the Jews are an inferior race, and now it's manifested as Zionism is racist. Like
colonialism.
Yeah, colonialism. It's like, I mean, even just that little piece of land we call Israel has a crazy history all the way back in ancient history. It was like split up into bunches of tribes before it was, and like tribe after tribe after tribe after tribe. It was like war after war after war after war between different tribes before it even became the land of Israel, because there it was just like a desolate piece of land that I guess saw a lot of battles and a lot of people wanted to take over there. But like, it just feels like unless you have even a small understanding of all of it, then you're probably not going to understand much of it. And that like overwhelms me. But I make it my business to educate myself on this stuff. Even if I don't retain the information, I still think it's important to like expose myself. The other day I was like, let's go onto YouTube and watch videos about all the tribes that fought in that land, like the Canaanites and the whatever else there were, the Byzantines or whatever, I don't know who it was. I didn't retain any of that information, but I still sat and watched it because it still added to like my like subconscious like level of understanding of the situation, I guess. But if you're not invested in it, why would you? I don't know, like what could we, I mean, World War II is obviously part of a school curriculum, the Holocaust, in Australia, at least, is still part of the curriculum. I don't know what it's like in America. I've heard that it's not being taught in schools anymore and that there's a lot of like rewriting history going on. I mean, even as someone who wasn't Jewish until she was 28 years old, like the fact that they're trying to like even change the New Testament was like offending me, like saying that Jesus was a Palestinian. I was like, it's like, you know, you can't just start like making up new stories, but I'm so scared that that's what's happening and I don't know how to fight that. That's like bigger than me. I don't know. It's like, leave that for the experts. But everyone else who feels something about this should make it their business to invest in learning about history, and not just Israel's history. The whole area, I think, from ancient to modern, you know, pick a subject and go learn about it and add it to your repertoire.
I love that. So my final question for you, Nikki, is firstly, thank you for your beautiful insights. What is your message to the world? Like, what is one thing that post 7th of October or in the current scene that we're in is like the most important message that every single person in the world really needs to hold on to during this time?
I mean, I feel like at the moment, everyone is just trying to scream louder than the next person. And so what I would want to tell people is to stop screaming and start talking. And if you feel like your voice isn't being heard, in certain spaces, then make it your business to go into those spaces. And even if you're just changing the mind of one person in that space, or at least humanizing yourself to that other person in that one space, then you have done a service to the good fight. I think we all need to just remember that we're all Hashem's children and that we all have that godly spark in us. And it's so easy to forget that real humans are being affected by this, whether it's here in Australia or in Israel or in America or wherever you are. And if you've never met a Jew before, maybe just go and sit with someone and talk to them and ask them, and not just the Jews that fit your narrative, but maybe expose yourself to people who you wouldn't have exposed yourself to otherwise in terms of getting to know someone on a human level. Because yes, at the moment, war and dismantling really evil organizations is important and necessary. But at the end of the day, like after all of this, we need to like remember that we cannot go back here. And I know that that's like a utopian dream, right? That there'll never be war again in the world. But the more we humanize each other and the more we learn about each other's practices and lifestyles, you know, like I used to post after the war 2 years ago, I said, right, I'm so done. It's so exhausting. I'm so done fighting this battle of anti-Semitism. Instead, I'm just going to show people my Jewish life and how beautiful it is and how a bit strange it is sometimes. And, you know, and people were so receptive to it. And so then when October 7 came, I had so much more support than I did 2 years ago. Wow. In my inbox, because I had showed them my life and I've shown them how beautiful it is and how meaningful it is and how real it is and how we're not sitting out here thinking that we're better than everyone else or that we're conspiring to like take over the world. We just want to live and let live. And a fundamental part of us, a fundamental part of Judaism, is allowing everyone to do that. You don't have to be Jewish to exist in this world. You don't have to believe what we believe. We don't believe that. We don't believe that you need to believe what we believe or observe the way that we observe for you to have a place in this world or a place in the next world. So, yeah, I think that was a big signifier to me that just by sharing how beautiful my life is, I have so many more people who are confident in their support of me than I did during the war 2 years ago. So I think we just, as Jews, we need to keep sharing our light and keep sharing how connected we are as to each other and to the land of Israel and to all our brothers and sisters in Israel, and just show like unity, biyachad, you know, like we just need to show everyone that we're all in this together. And I would say my advice for Jews is to stop. Like right now, it's so important for us to be united. And whether you have different political views to someone else, like whether you think this person should be posting this on social media or not talking about pop culture on social media, like that's not for you to say. We don't need to tear each other down right now for really menial things. We need to be strong and stand with each other and just respect everyone's journey and how they're processing this and remind each other that like at the end of the day, when everyone else is going to turn their back on us, we only have each other. And so whatever happens, I'm here for you.
Thank you. That was beautiful.
Pleasure.